You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, everybody. I'm NPR Chief Meteorologist Paul Huttner, sitting in for Angela Davis today. Welcome to a special edition of Ask the Meteorologist and ClimateCast here on NPR News. We're watching Hurricane Barry wind up along the Louisiana coast today, and the flood forecast will test levees there. Here in Minnesota, a soggy, smoky start to the season formerly known as summer. So today it's your chance to ask the meteorologist. We can play a little weather geek here. If you want to talk about our crazy weather so far this year, give us a call with your question or comment. Jump in 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. We're really lucky to have two very special guests today here on NPR News. Kenny Blumenfeld is a senior climatologist with the Minnesota DNR Climate Working Group. Welcome back, Kenny.
Good to be here, Paul.
You're getting frequent flyer miles this year, I think.
Aren't you guys tired of me yet?
Not yet. And you see him on Care 11 Sunrise. Meteorologist Sven Sundgaard joins us today by phone. Hi, Sven.
Good morning.
How are you today? How was the morning show?
Well, pretty good. Always good on a Friday.
Yeah, best day of the week. Listen, guys, the biggest breaking weather news today, obviously Hurricane Barry. The latest stats, 100 miles or so just southwest of the mouth of the Mississippi, 65-mile-an-hour winds. But the big story looks like rain here, maybe 4 to 8 to 12 inches for New Orleans, maybe 10 to 20 west of New Orleans. Sven, does it still look to you like flooding from heavy rainfall is the biggest risk there?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think everybody's become familiar with the topography of Louisiana after, unfortunately, large storms starting with Katrina. So, and they also had, what a lot of people don't realize, they also had some very heavy rain earlier this week, too, in that area. So the ground is already saturated. And, you know, remember with Harvey a couple years ago when the models were spitting out those ridiculously high amounts, you didn't really believe it. But now, when the models are doing that with Barry, it's a lot more believable since we've been seeing these extreme rainfall events with these tropical systems especially.
Kenny, the flood situation there, kind of a 1-2 punch. We had heavy runoff from the Mississippi from spring snowmelt and all the rain we've had in the Midwest. And now we throw a tropical system on top of that. That really is going to test those levees down there.
Yeah, indeed. It's, it's kind of hard to believe that we're actually up here contributing to the problem they're experiencing in Louisiana just by virtue of our very heavy snows in the spring and then the rain that we had after that.
And that all, of course, runs down the Mississippi. I see the latest forecast, 19 feet on the Mississippi River in New Orleans. The levees are 20 feet. So, Sven, we're testing them. We're getting close. Hopefully everything holds out for New Orleans.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it all depends on the specific track. It does appear, like as you mentioned, that the heaviest rainfall may be just west of them. And certainly the wind, which is in this storm, is just more insult to injury because the rain is going to be the biggest concern. But if you can keep those near hurricane force winds further west too, that would be obviously helpful. But yeah, this will be kind of a test for New Orleans to see how well they've prepared after past storms.
And it seems like we're always talking about New Orleans when it comes to flooding. Let's talk a little bit about the unique flood geography that is New Orleans. I've got a clip here from NPR's Debbie Elliott. Let's listen to it and talk about it on the other side.
Earlier this week, a heavy rain inundated the city and kind of crippled parts of it. And so the city is already saturated. It's like a big bowl that's basically surrounded by water. Mayor LaToya Cantrell says the city's pumps are running at optimal levels. There are no problems there, but she says that might not be enough.
And Kenny, that's a great description. New Orleans is a bowl. I saw this great graphic with a cross section, and there's this bowl with berms and then levees on either side. That's a dicey situation for them long term.
Yeah, being below sea level and just having the water kind of find you. Not an optimal situation, indeed.
Sven, when you look at this, and I know you do a lot of reporting on climate change, when we think about places like the Louisiana coast, places like New Orleans, What are the connections there when we start to get these tropical systems moving in?
Well, for us, I'd say, you know, I call it weather atmospheric constipation in terms of how, you know, people wonder how this affects us, but it can kind of block the pattern, and that's got to be at least a contributor to the fact that we're going to stay kind of locked into the hot and humid pattern next week. But also this can feed into systems that we see and, you know, make our rainfall more extreme too. You know, I think most Minnesotans know by now that a lot of our summer rainfall is directly a result of Gulf air and Gulf moisture that feeds straight up the plains into us. So, you know, anything that develops here that can tap into that can be an issue as well.
Kenny, there have been some Minnesota connections with tropical cyclones in the past, right?
Yeah, indeed. And, you know, when people get asked, you've probably been asked this too, oh, do hurricanes or tropical storms ever really affect Minnesota? I think what people are assuming is, you know, that the remnants of the eye is going to pass right overhead, or we're going to see some kind of strong winds. That's obviously not what we really experience. What we do experience is something more like what Sven just described, although there's a bit of a meteorological mechanism in there. And we get these, they're called predecessor rain events, where the leftovers of the hurricane or tropical storm kind of drift across the Midwest, somewhere in the southern half of the United States. But just as Sven said, the airflows are such that as a weather system passes through the region, and especially when it gets stuck, it taps into some of that excess moisture, and you get these blossoming thunderstorms. And sometimes it's just bands of heavy rain without much lightning or thunder at all. And there's a pretty clear signature in the state record rainfall from August of 2007 down in Hoka, Minnesota, that actually had this kind of predecessor rainfall event, tropical connection that we're talking about.
So it was a way that we juice the atmosphere here locally by adding all that moisture from remnant tropical systems.
Indeed. And if you think of the way our heavy rainfall operates when there's not a tropical weather system at play, we're already dealing with anomalously rich moisture in the atmosphere. And so if we then just add on top of that, these storms can really go crazy. And that's, I think, why in August of 2007, people were scratching their heads because we'd never really seen anything like that. And I think although we have no real evidence, we could speculate that what we often consider to be one of the heaviest, probably the heaviest rainfall ever recorded in Minnesota in the last 200 years, although it doesn't have a lot of official measurements, is out near the Chippewa River in western Minnesota. This was also early August, and there are estimates that, you know, 25 to 30 inches of rain fell, and we'd have to speculate that if that is indeed the case, that there was a tropical connection with that also.
You know, and I remember I worked in Tucson, Arizona for 9 years, so we'd watch these tropical systems spin off the eastern Pacific and then recurve. And I remember watching some of that moisture get sucked up into the upper Midwest as well. So we can also get some tropical Pacific moisture into some of these systems.
Yeah, indeed. And with some of the new tools on the GOES 16 satellite, you can actually see this happening. You can look at the water vapor channels and actually see the moisture getting transported over the mountains in the mid and upper atmosphere right into our region. It's pretty neat.
Paul Huttner here with
Pineapple Express.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Sven.
Oh, I was just saying Pineapple Express.
Yes, there you go. Paul Huttner here with fellow meteorologists and weather geeks, Kenny Blumenfeld and Sven Sundgaard. It's Ask the Meteorologist today on NPR News. And if you want to talk about our crazy Minnesota weather, if you have a question or a comment, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. All right, guys, let's refine that focus on Minnesota a little bit. We've talked about the moisture. It's been a crazy few weather years here, and wetness seems to be the constant theme. I mean, it just doesn't stop. Sven, my weather chats on NPR and Updraft this week, I talked about the fourth wettest year on record for Minnesota in the past 12 months. I think Rochester is having the wettest year on record so far. They've already had 30 inches of precipitation. Which weather numbers are jumping out at you this year?
You know, I think for me, it's the extreme rainfalls that we've been seeing, you know, we're just sort of talking about, but here in Minnesota too, you know, remember when a 4, 5, 6 inch rainfall was much more rare, and now they're happening with more regularity in different spots. And it's the volatility of it too. You don't know necessarily where it's going to be. June was actually a little below normal for us. But, you know, I was out of the country for half the month, so I was surprised to come back and see that we actually were a little drier than normal. But Rochester and southwestern Minnesota was a very different story. It continued the very wet trend that we had. And I was actually out in western Minnesota yesterday doing some stories on the prairie out there and the Minnesota Zoo working with reintroducing an endangered butterfly. And I was shocked at how many flooded farm fields there were between the South Dakota border and here. Almost
still,
every cornfield, yeah, had huge puddles and ponds. You could tell these were not areas that were bodies of water because you can see where the rows of corn disappeared all of a sudden into the water. And obviously some of the worst of it was around Redwood Falls that saw that very heavy rainfall. Was that early last week or the week before, that 5 to 7 inches. But that whole area still between here and there flooded farm fields.
Kenny, you look at the longer term numbers. Yeah, this has been a tough spring and summer for many farmers with the wetness, but that's a trend, isn't it?
Yeah, we have multiple sort of overlapping trends here. One is we have the long-term trend that really goes back about 40 or 50 years towards wetter conditions over most of Minnesota. But then we have this kind of hyper-concentrated trend in the last decade or so, where we're looking at being the wettest decade on record throughout much of Minnesota, especially the southeastern half. And then it appears that the last couple years are sort of an exclamation point within that hyper-concentrated trend, where we're just, you know, and after 2016, when Waseca broke the rainfall record, annual rainfall record for Minnesota, we thought, okay, that we're going to start going down now. And then, of course, both Caledonia and Harmony broke that record again last year.
And let's talk about that for a second, because 60 inches of rain last year in southeast Minnesota,
That's
like almost New Orleans or Tallahassee, Florida average annual rainfall. That's just off the charts for Minnesota.
Yeah, we hadn't officially observed anything even close to that until this past year.
Sven, you talked about southwest Minnesota. I'm watching the Doppler here with a pretty strong thunderstorm that looks like it has hail right around Cottonwood right now. You know, we've seen these kind of heavy rainfall events. They extend into late summer, sometimes lately fall. Julia in Stillwater calls in today and asks us, I'm a farmer and I wonder what the outlook for fall is looking like here. We know the El Nino, La Nina cycles tend to affect winter more. What's your take on the upcoming fall? Any signs there?
Boy, I don't, you know, I think trying to predict what will, you know, what the precipitation will continue to do is pretty difficult because I think, you know, while the trends are wetter and wetter, of course, for the whole state and all of us, it's also very volatile where it can completely shut off too. So it's hard to say. I think our falls have been trending much warmer, and I don't know about the precipitation. Maybe Kenny can talk about that. But it seems like this wet pattern that started really in February, it just is continuing until we see some mechanism that shuts that down. It's hard to believe we won't just continue to see more of the same overall.
Kenny, what about trends in the fall? What are you seeing there?
I think Sven got it right. We've definitely been getting a lot warmer in the fall. And of course, you know, the volatility that Sven talked about is really important because we're not talking, it's not guaranteed that you're going to have a warm fall every year. It's just that the majority of our recent falls have been warm. And so that's led to fall being the second fastest warming season in Minnesota. It's warming, you know, 6 to 8 times faster than summer. Winter warming more like 10 times faster than summer. In terms of precipitation, it's been pretty hit or miss. We've seen some really big rainfall events in sort of mid-late September and early October over the last 1 to 2 decades. But we've also seen some real drying during fall also. So we see volatility and change there. It's hard to, I agree with Sven, it's hard to make a forecast that far out. And it makes me happy I'm just a climatologist.
Yeah, and you know, yeah, go ahead, Sven.
Well, just, you know, and we got to remember too that forecasting that long term is very difficult. You know, this was supposed to be a weak El Nino winter, which would tend to favor a mild winter, and it ended up not being one. So, you know, so predicting the precipitation patterns is even more difficult.
Yeah, and boy, I feel, I'm always thinking about Minnesota farmers when I look at these numbers and driving through some of the fields. I live in eastern Carver County, so I see my share of fields every week. Mm-hmm. And boy, talk about a tough job. How about being a farmer in Minnesota? Listen, let's pivot, you guys, because the heat is finally coming, right? Summer, it seems like, took forever to get here. Although, interestingly, I noticed even with only one 90-degree day so far in the Twin Cities, June was 1 degree warmer than average. Yeah. July is running several degrees warmer than average so far. And here comes the heat, finally. And, Kenny, it's not always the heat, it's the humidity. But really, it's the dew point. And some of the models for the weekend into next week suggesting dew points in the mid, maybe upper 70s, maybe even 80 degrees. And I had a question come in from Twitter here. Are we seeing a higher frequency of high dew point episodes in summer in Minnesota?
Yeah, it's a question we get a lot. And the answer is actually not yet.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we have the caveat is that our records are, you know, we have really good records in the Twin Cities that we can push back pretty far, but they become a lot spottier when you go to other places. But if you look at the counts of hours or days that are spent with dew points registering at least one time or numerous hours above 70 degrees, we're really not seeing a big bump up in recent years. What we are seeing, though, and this is kind of the nuance of it, is we're not seeing as many of those really cool, crisp days where the dew points are really low. And so I think what people are noticing is that inability to sort of ventilate some of the humidity that's built up. So even though we're not seeing real increases in the extremes of dew points yet, we are seeing kind of a shaving off of the bottom of that summertime distribution. So we don't have the days very frequently between, say, June and August, where the dew points fall below 50 degrees. And that used to be something we'd see a little bit more. And we're spending more of the time with the dew point right around 60 degrees, which you do start to notice that.
Yeah, it's amazing how these subtle changes are measurable, right? In the metrics that you guys do. I mean, I remember Pete Boulay went out into the cornfield, right, in St. Paul a few years ago on a calm day and measured dew points right above the cornfield and then outside of the cornfield. And I think he got like a 5 degree higher dew point reading. I know that's just one metric there. But Sven, corn sweat, it's a thing, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, we talk about that all the time. And you notice it in the summer, especially since when our wind is coming from the humid direction, which is the south. What's it blown across? Well, Iowa, which is full of cornfields, and even southern Minnesota, you definitely see that spike in dew point once the corn is growing a little higher.
Kenny?
But that used to be our saving grace, too, is that we would get those dry breaks of Canadian air that Kenny was talking about. And that is something, while I haven't quantified it like he has, that is something that we seem to notice, especially this year, that the dew point drops, but, yeah, only to maybe 60 instead of when it would have been 55 or 50, and maybe for a couple days instead of, you know, three quarters of a day like yesterday.
Yeah, one of the things that I guess I would throw in is we have to remember, too, we're stuck in July right now, and we're all kind of thinking right now, right now, right now, but June was pretty much a phenomenal month.
And using, it was great.
Using the Summer Glory Index, it was one of the finest on record in the Twin Cities anyway. It was like the third nicest June we've had. And we did have a lot of those kind of, at least we didn't have a lot of hot days. But one of the things that we speculate about, and I saw it come out of the National Weather Service discussions, is because the wet winter and spring took out a lot of corn. I mean, there's a lot of corn that just didn't get planted. And a lot of the corn that's growing is behind schedule in terms of its growth cycle. So we kind of wonder how much of a role that's going to have in evapotranspiration and putting extra moisture into the air. I mean, sure, where you have corn, there'll be additional low-level moisture for sure. But what about the places where you don't? And what about the fact that corn's a couple weeks behind? Is that going to affect what we see?
All right. This is Ask the Meteorologist, so we ought to answer some listener questions, I think. You guys up for that?
I'm in.
Sure.
Jay and Chaska, good morning. How are you, sir? And what is your question for Sven Sundgaard and Kenny Blumenfeld?
Well, first of all, I used to be a board operator and announcer on Maine Public Radio, and whenever we would give the weather forecast, I don't remember ever delivering either the dew point or the heat index. We just gave the temperature, and of course, in Maine, we would always give the Celsius temperature, as we had listeners in New Brunswick. But what is the difference between the heat index and the dew point? And I'll hang up and listen.
Great question, Jay, and great radio pipes, too, clearly. Sven, dew point and heat index, we get that a lot. It's all yours.
Yeah, and of course they're related. And, you know, and we're guilty of this, too, because it's a little simpler to use the terminology with the public when we say, oh, the humidity is going up or it's humid. And of course, we have relative humidity, which is relative to how much water is in the air compared to what it can hold. The warmer the air, the more water it can hold. But the dew point is that direct measurement of how much water is in the air. We can actually convert it to grams of water per kilogram of air. So the higher the dew point, it is directly correlated with more moisture. And the heat index is the result of combining the temperature and the dew point. And that's when you get the feels-like temperature that goes higher. So even today, for example, the dew point approaching 70 by later in the afternoon, that, you know, 88 degrees we might experience later now feels like 93. And I was looking at, you know, Monday looks particularly steamy, where 92, 93, 94 degrees is going to feel more like 100 plus because of those dew points. So you really see the effect of it once that dew point is in the upper 60s or higher with the temperature.
Yeah, and one of the things that some of the health professionals look at is that that black globe wet bulb temperature, which is sort of it's kind of like a morphed heat index, and it has to do with how cool you can actually get through evaporation of
it's
water.
It's how hard or easy it is for us to sweat.
Yeah, it's a heat stress metric, and that actually has temperatures that end up being lower than heat index values, but they're also – so you watch for values in the – you know, mid and upper 80s means that's about as cool as it's going to ever feel like through sweat and evaporation of your perspiration. So,
all right.
Yeah, you can notice the difference jumping into a Minnesota lake or pool. Do it on a humid day versus, and, you know, try to remember what it felt like and then do it in a couple weeks when maybe we get a drier dew point day. The effect of evaporation on your skin is pretty different.
Yeah, great to jump in the lake this time of year. Just watch it around Big Island these days from what I'm hearing. So listen, let's pivot a little bit. I got this question, record highs to record lows. How are they trending over the last couple of decades in Minnesota and around the nation? Climate Central did a study that puts the ratio at 1.8 record highs for every record low in the 2000s and 2010s. Kenny, are you seeing that kind of a trend here?
Oh, indeed. And in fact, our esteemed colleague Mark Seely has cataloged this pretty extensively in his weather almanacs. And one of the things that he pointed out was that is essentially it's the record high minimum temperature. So the sort of the warmest that a given night has been.
The overnight low temperature, as we often say.
Yeah, so those really warm overnight lows, that's where we're actually seeing some of the big records, some of the big changes. So it's not, so we're not breaking record lows very frequently at all. And it's like basically a factor of 10 increase. So yeah, although we are getting warmer, where we're really getting the warmest is when it's supposed to be cold. And so we're breaking these sort of the warmest, the coldest has ever been types of records.
Sven, you know, Care 11 is one of the, I think, very few TV stations, in my opinion, that report responsibly on climate change connections in Minnesota. And you've done some great work there. What's the reaction from your management and audience and the, you know, the editorial approach to reporting on climate change?
I would say that management is fairly supportive, though I can have some stories from the past. But because, of course, they're always worried about not angering a portion of your viewers. And so I think one of the positive trends that I can say in the 13 years I've been at CARE is there's a lot fewer, I call them trolls or pushback from people when you do report on something climate change related. They're still out there on Twitter. They always will be. But there's, you know, the public, and I think polling shows this too, the public has definitely accepted the facts of climate change because we're starting to really see those effects more and more.
Kenny, this is part of your work at the Climate Working Group. How has that grown for you, and what kind of a reaction do you get?
I mean, I think that, you know, kind of depends on where you are and which audience you're dealing with. Some of our audiences are kind of already on board and don't need to be convinced of anything. And others are more reserved. And I think, you know, if we can strip out some of the terminology that can be politically divisive and just focus on, well, what are we talking about? What's happening? And what are some of the reasons? We've actually seen a lot of people kind of flip over if they don't see it as a political issue, but instead as one that's affecting their lives in apolitical ways. So out in parts of rural Minnesota, where maybe it's important to earn some trust on this topic first, you have to talk about the things that we've been talking about today. Oh, warmer winters, more water in your fields during the growing season, harder to move water out of the field after multiple heavy rainfall events. And these are actually the symptoms of the changing climate that we see. But a lot of times people aren't making those connections because the very term climate change has turned them off from the topic altogether. So kind of making it, helping them see it as personal has definitely helped reach some of those more resistant audiences.
And we're going to talk a little bit about the language around climate change here in the second half hour. Speaking of Southwest Minnesota, I just want to make sure we reiterate the severe thunderstorm warning that is now in effect for northwestern Redwood County and southeastern Yellow Medicine County until 11:45. Severe thunderstorm located over Cottonwood. That's a storm we talked about a few minutes ago, a little bit north of Marshall, moving east at 50 miles an hour. Hail quarter size with this, and potentially some very strong winds as this storm right now sitting, looks like a hail core sitting right over Cottonwood, you guys. What else will you be watching, Sven, for the second half of this year in Minnesota and beyond? Any trends or any things that are on your radar looking ahead?
You know, I'm looking for the trend that we break this pattern we've been into since February, the overall cooler and wetter than normal period. You know, we were talking a little bit about what does the fall bring. Well, you know, that tends to kind of set up here a lot of times in late summer. And, you know, what was remarkable, we talked about June ended up warmer than normal. Well, that was the first warmer than normal month since December and kind of illustrates the complexity of climate. You know, I think Minnesotans in the past thought climate change is a win-win for us. Oh, warmer climate, awesome. We'll have palm trees and life will be great. Well, this is a volatile climate. You know, we keep using the word volatility, and that's what makes predicting things so difficult. The trends keep going warmer and wetter, of course, but you're still going to have, because it's a place that can go from drought to floods, those extremes become more extreme. And because we're still going to get winter, folks, we're not going to get out of that. We're seeing, you know, we've seen this a couple of times in the recent years where we're draining out some of the coldest air on the planet that normally shouldn't be here. And I know there's research into this, but one of the theories is that we're weakening the jet streams because the Arctic is warming faster than anywhere else on the planet. So it's not just this isn't all rosy picture for Minnesota. So I'm looking to see, do we finally break that pattern and we get back into what we have been seeing for years and years, one month after another of warmer than normal temperatures and drier or closer to normal precipitation? Because, you know, while June was a little dry here only, it seemed, July for the Twin Cities, what we're seeing, I think, double the normal rainfall for the month already.
Kenny, it's interesting to look at those global maps of temperature departure, average temperature, and you see red over much of the planet. And there has been this persistent blue blob over the upper Midwest, southern Canada, for it seems like the last couple of years.
Yeah, you almost feel like the walls are kind of closing in there, though. It's because the majority of the landmass and even a lot of the ocean areas are red or, you know, warm, running warm anomalies. Yeah, I'm also looking for not just this pattern ending, but, you know, we're talking about the heavy rains in Rochester and Redwood Falls. And Redwood Falls has had, I want to say, their cooperative observer at Redwood Falls has registered a 5-inch rainfall or greater. It's either 4 or 5 of the last 6 years, which is, that's unheard of. We don't have anything like that on record. That's a real anomaly. But this has happened this year without a kind of classical extreme rainfall setup. So I'm watching for, do we get the sort of, you know, the mega rain, the really widespread heavy rainfall? Do the precipitation anomalies get distributed around the state a little better rather than just focusing on southern Minnesota? And I'm also watching for, you know, signs of what winter looks like, because southwestern Minnesota's had back-to-back record-breaking winters. The Marshall area had nearly 80 inches of snow 2 winters in a row. And so we're kind of watching for that too.
Thus the water in the fields and Redwood Falls. Here comes another storm. It's right on your doorstep to the north and west right now. Kenny Blumenfeld, senior climatologist with the Minnesota DNR Climate Working Group, and CARE 11 Sunrise meteorologist Sven Sundgaard. So good talking to both of you. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Good to be on.
Thank you.
We pivot now to climate casting. You know, there's an interesting trend that I've been really sort of caught my eye and grabbed my attention recently. British newspaper The Guardian recently decided to use the terms climate crisis or climate emergency instead of climate change. They say it's more accurate. Of course, environmentalists applaud that. Critics are groaning. And there is now clear attribution science that measures how Earth's warmer, wetter atmosphere is supercharging these extreme weather events that we're seeing. So here's the question today. What language most accurately describes these more extreme weather events and the increasingly costly impacts that they're creating on our changing planet? And when does language that's too extreme hurt more than it helps? Genevieve Gunther directs endclimatesilence.org. That's an organization that helps the media link stories about climate change impacts to climate change. And she teaches at the New School in New York. Welcome back, Genevieve.
Thank you so much for having me, Paul.
And Bobby McGill is the president of the Society of Environmental Journalists and the Energy and Public Lands reporter for Bloomberg Environment. Hey, Bobby.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Great to have both of you today. I think this is an important discussion. Genevieve, let's start with you. What do you think about a major news organization like The Guardian changing their language to describe climate change as a climate crisis or climate emergency?
Well, I'm all for it, because I actually think it's a more accurate way to describe what's happening to our planetary system from the perspective of human beings. Climate change is a scientific term. It describes any change in climate parameters, for example, rainfall or wind, and it doesn't have to be global, nor does it have to be human-caused. But we know that this episode of climate change is caused by human activities, namely the burning of fossil fuels, or mostly the burning of fossil fuels. And we know that we have to stabilize the concentration of greenhouse gases in our atmosphere and halt warming so that we don't experience an utter breakdown of the climactic system that enabled civilization to establish itself and thrive. So from my perspective, to call what we're in right now greenhouse gas concentrations of over 400 parts per million a climate emergency is an accurate description of the situation that we're in. It works better than climate change, which from my perspective has all sorts of positive connotations which complicate it as a term to be used in human discussions.
Bobby, you're a climate journalist. I'm a climate journalist. We know the language we use is important. Is there such a thing as going too far to be effective when we're communicating climate changes?
Well, look, this is something that's this change on the part of The Guardian has been a bit of a debate among those of us in the environmental journalism community. But I don't think you're going to see other news organizations make this change anytime soon. I think in part because that language, I think, is perceived as a bit partisan. I think it's perceived as a value judgment. And we would report that the climate is changing, that climate change is occurring, that it's human caused. And there are numerous repercussions of that. But to call it an emergency or a crisis is something that we would have to attribute to. I also think there's some question and some nervousness on the part of, or some doubt really, on the part of other editors who might consider this change. As The Guardian sort of leads the way in this, there's a possible credibility issue. This smacks of activism, I think. The Guardian has teamed up with 350.org to, as part of their Leave It in the Ground campaign, and journalists are simply not in the business of putting an entire industry out of business. We are here to report the facts, to leave value judgments to others, and attribute those judgments to sources.
Genevieve, I'm interested in your reaction to that. What about that line between being an activist and being a neutral journalist when it comes to climate change?
Well, I feel for journalists who are under tremendous pressure from all quarters, who are being attacked by the President of the United States as being entirely partisan. The right wing in our country has politicized climate change. It's turned an understanding of the consequences of climate change into some sort of political opinion, as if it weren't just an acceptance of reality, but it was somehow, a position you take in order to sort of sneak socialism in through the back door. So I understand why environmental journalists might be reluctant to adopt language that they see as value-laden. From my perspective, if an asteroid were shooting towards Earth and were slated to kill hundreds of millions of people in the next decades, and we knew this as a scientific fact, for sure the media would call it an emergency. So from my perspective, to call it an emergency, to call it a crisis, is, again, an accurate representation of what climate change is for human beings. So I don't agree that it smacks of activism. To me, not to represent it in these terms smacks of having been affected by playing the ref, that you've been accused of bias so much that you actually misrepresent something in order to try to prove your objectivity.
You're listening to ClimateCast here on NPR News. I'm Paul Huttner. The question today, how should we as news organizations talk about and describe climate change? What's the most accurate way to do that? And join the conversation if you like, 651-227-6000 or 800-242-2828. Bobby, we've seen, you know, some big advances in weather attribution science. We can link these individual extreme weather events to climate changes like warmer oceans, more water vapor in the atmosphere. How is that sort of attribution science working into your writing?
Well, I'd say it's complicated. I mean, you know, most of the journalists who are members of SEJ and in my own reporting will we will report the influence of climate change on any given weather event. Just this week, for example, here in Washington, D.C., we had, you know, the most intense rainfall ever recorded over a period of an hour in its history, and just down the street from my office, as a matter of fact. And, you know, this, the Washington Post reported on this, and at the end of the story, they said it's more likely that, you know, in a warming world, these events will happen because of a warmer atmosphere will contain more moisture, and these are more likely, these events are more likely to occur. We have to, it's all about context, and I think that reporters, if they report the facts with sufficient context, they can convey the urgency of the issue of climate change, and they can illustrate, in this case, there was a demonstrable emergency locally. And I think what The Guardian is trying to get at is that climate change is an emergency globally, and as an existential crisis. And again, I think that's something that needs to be attributed.
And let's assess a minute here, you know, just what is a climate emergency or a climate crisis. I want to talk about a couple of extreme weather events with clear climate change attribution links. California wildfires last fall. PG&E was liable for something like $25 billion in losses there because their power lines sparked the fires. And that actually caused them to declare bankruptcy. And many observers, financial insurance observers, are saying this is the first climate change-driven bankruptcy of a Fortune 500 company. Now, PG&E is number 183 on the latest Fortune 500 list with $16 billion in annual revenue. So I guess let me start with you, Bobby. If a Fortune 500 company goes bankrupt because of climate change, isn't that a climate crisis for that company and for ratepayers in California?
It may be. It's something that I don't think, as a journalist, I can just say that it's a climate crisis. I think that we have to attribute that to the company itself, to scientists, to others in the field who are more expert than I am in determining whether that's a climate crisis.
Genevieve, I also, just as a tag to that, the San Francisco Chronicle reporting that the California Assembly just voted 63-8 in favor of a bill designed to create a fund of at least $21 billion to pay claims from future wildfires started by electric equipment. And here on ClimateCast, I often say, follow the money. Climate change is already costing us billions. We're just getting started here. What's your perspective on this entire situation?
I mean, from my perspective, I feel like extreme weather events are sort of only one piece of the overall challenge that we're facing. We're also facing the fact that the vast majority of the crops in the Midwest haven't been planted yet because the ground is still flooded from the intense rainfall of a few months ago in that region of our nation. We are faced with an immigration crisis as the tropics become more arid and hotter, and the agriculture, which has sustained most people living in the tropics, won't be able to be practiced anymore. We are facing stranded assets as people have to retreat from the coastlines. What about all the value of real estate in Florida, in Miami, in the California coast? So this is not just about hurricanes and wildfires and these sort of like things that happen and then you have to recover from. This is a complete and utter breakdown of everything that sustains our economy and our very bodies. So I can understand why an environmental or a science journalist would really want to stick to sort of attribution science and report the facts. But there are other kinds of journalism which are going to be really important moving forward, who maybe would need to say that this is a financial emergency, or this is going to be an emergency in our food system, or a drought is going to be an emergency. And so I'm happy to kind of subsume all those different kinds of perspectives into an overall claim that we are in a climate emergency. If we do not draw our emissions down to zero by 2050, the devastation is going to be pretty much unimaginable and ongoing and irreparable. We cannot change our minds and take it back later. So to me, I feel like the question of whether you should stick to attribution when you're reporting extreme weather events is only one part of the question. For me, it's a much larger issue.
Well, this is a great conversation. We're lighting up the phones here. So let's take a call. Dick in Excelsior, good morning. What's your question for Genevieve or Bobby?
Well, good morning. My comment is that I think that we're putting the reporting group in a tough situation, because from a science standpoint, what we're dealing with is a dynamic system. And the expectation a lot of people have is that we have equilibrium and we're going to have stable patterns. But the more energy we put into the globe and realize that there's seasonal changes, so that one part is getting the hotter sun and the other's the cooler, the dynamics are going to change, and the more energy that's in the overall system, the more volatility we're going to have, and the patterns are going to change. And, you know, if you go back to the science, you can talk about Lorenz and what they talked about from a chaos standpoint. If you want to look at it from an economic cost perspective, it means that it's not going to be predictable. My supply chains for my businesses, my agricultural climates and so forth are all going to change and show volatility. And trying to predict exactly when those storms are going to come and how they're going to come becomes less and less possible.
Dick,
that's just the nature of the dynamic systems.
Yep, great question. Let me throw that to Bobby. Bobby, I talk to a lot of corporate CEOs here. They're already seeing climate change show up in their supply chains. How do we process that and that volatility and the science as journalists?
Well, we report that for one thing, you know, let's say I'm writing about wildfires. I'm free to report that the research shows that climate change is contributing to increasingly volatile conditions, leading to, you know, increasingly volatile wildfire weather, or weather that would cause wildfires to burn in a more extreme way. And I think that if we cite the research, we can say that those things are occurring. But I can't just come out and say this is a climate emergency, this is a climate crisis, and it just needs to be attributed.
Okay, fair enough. Kurt in Lee Center, good morning. What's your question this morning?
Hi guys, how are you? Thanks for taking my call. It's more of a comment than a question. My comment, I guess, and to both of the people that are guessing your show is, there was a quote that was made earlier about the weather emergency being the same, comparing it to an asteroid, which is going to fall to the Earth and kill 100 million people in the next decade. It's comments like that and people that report them in the media that shy me away from paying more attention to climate control, because in all honesty, there's no possible way they can predict that 100 million lives will be lost or 10 million lives will be lost due to climate change, due to what human beings are doing to the planet. I firmly believe that we have climate change happening, but we have a president right now who got elected, in my opinion, because he kept saying things that people wanted to hear, or that, you know, other people were saying things that they couldn't believe. I don't believe that we're going to lose 100 million lives. Why don't we just address it the way that it is instead of trying to make everything so dramatic? Because I understand it's changing, but let's face it, it's not. There's no science that they can show me that is accurate that can tell me that there's 100 million lives that are going to be lost. And how do you report that to us, who want to listen to the news and get things accurate?
Great question, Kurt. Bobby, go ahead, jump in.
Comment, if that's okay.
Sure, Genevieve, you start, and then Bobby, you jump in.
Let me just clarify that I didn't say 100 million people were going to die in the next decade. I said in the coming decades, hundreds of millions of people could die if we don't draw down emissions. And let me tell you why I say this. The special report released by the IPCC in October of 2018 on the difference between 1.5 and 2 degrees Celsius of warming pointed out that if we warm to 2 degrees Celsius, which at this point is our absolute best case scenario, that means that 80 million people, 32 to 80 million people will be displaced from their homes because they will be subject to ongoing flooding, which absent massive amounts of adaptation, which might not be possible anyway because all of these regions are in poor nations of the world, they will be displaced from their homes and they will be migrating. So that's going to cause tremendous geopolitical instability. 400 million people are going to be subject to ongoing and irreversible drought. They're not going to have enough water to drink. And 1 billion people are going to be subject to starvation because the coral reefs, which provide the sort of spawning ground for the seafood that forms the basis of their diets, will have disappeared. So when you see numbers like that, and you know that even now about 400,000 people a year are already dying from causes that can be attributed to climate change, you see that we are in danger. And so I understand that this sounds terrifying and alarmist and almost mind-boggling, but that's because it is. I mean, that's what it means to say that climate change is an existential crisis. So that it doesn't sound like it's based in the science, but there is science behind the sense that we absolutely have to stop burning fossil fuels.
Guys, we're getting a little tight on time here. Bobby, a quick comment, and then we'll jump to one more question.
I just want to say that there is, that, and I agree with Genevieve, there is ample science that suggests that this is, or it certainly could be, an existential crisis for humanity. So those are details that we have to include in our stories as journalists. But we have to be very clear, and we have to be very careful about the language we use so that we can include this information, this context, while also not turning off the potential, large other audience who would be repelled by, extraordinarily alarmist declarations from a journalist without attributing that to specific scientists or reports. I report on the oil and gas industry, and I can't call up somebody from the oil and gas industry and say, that I'm writing about the climate crisis. I have to talk about the impacts of climate change and say that in a very measured way. And otherwise, it sounds very partisan. It sounds like I've taken sides.
All right, Bobby.
We aren't taking sides. We're just reporting what the research says.
Let me jump in real quick. One more quick call. Kim, hello from Minneapolis. We're really tight on time. If you can just make it short. Thank you.
Hi, thanks for taking my time. I understand the importance of the language that we use, particularly among journalists, but there are not sides. The reality is that I agree with Genevieve. The research is clear. I have two young children, and one of them, who's just turned 20, is worried that she has no future. I'm going to be participating in Al Gore's Climate Reality project in August 2nd through the 4th here in the Twin Cities. So I'm excited about doing that with my 16-year-old daughter.
Fantastic.
So my comment is, what about climate reality? Because that's where we're at.
Well, that's a great term and a great question. Real quick, guys, I got like 5 seconds. Climate reality, does that ring a bell?
I think I understand why Mr. Gore likes that term. But I think it's ambiguous.
All right, listen.
I think that the last thing we need to do, however, is calibrate our language.
Thank
you.
Thank you both so much. I'm coming up against the clock here. Genevieve Gunther with the New School and Bobby McGill with Bloomberg. Thanks so much.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to the conversation, you can call in at 651-227-6000 or tweet us at Angela Davis NPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. You can send us your questions or comments by emailing talk@npr.org.